Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series. That's toughmantri.com. RunCatalina.com, Catalina Eco Marathon, Half Marathon 10K, coming up Saturday, November 18th. VeloFix.com, the coolest mobile bike shop around. ATVSwimSpas.com, the official training vessel for six-time Ironman World Champion Dave Scott. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation, DonateCAF.com, which has sent out 2,448 grants totaling $3.7 million. To keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport, and you can check out any of our interviews on Babbittville.com, on iTunes, and as always, endurance lives here. Speaking of CAF grants, our next guest, Paralympic silver and bronze medalist and a gentleman who just ran up at Sacramento State this past weekend, Mr. Blake Leeper. Blake, so great to have you back on the show. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How you doing, sir? How's things going?
Everything is wonderful, and what makes things really wonderful for me is having you back running on a track with somebody actually with a watch keeping track of what you're doing and having it count, because it's been way too long.
Oh, my gosh. You have no idea. Just being back on the track, you know, it's been almost 2 years that I had to take a sideline to the track, and you've been there, and you know my story, and just being back there and running in front of the crowd and making NBC and breaking some records, it was just, oh, the greatest feeling in the world, Bob. It really was. It was the greatest feeling in the world.
So, first of all, you haven't run a race since the Paralympic Trials last year, and I think the last race you did, you did the 100, and your leg came flying off.
Yeah, so I ran the 100 meters, actually went 10.98 with the last 5 meters, almost 10 meters down, my right leg pops off, and it pops off, and I had to basically fall across the line, and so everybody was like, it scared everybody, I was like, but it made some cool TV, because that was one of the first time Paralympic Trials was ever on NBC last year.
I know.
In history, so just being there, the whole world watching the first race ever on national TV, and the leg comes off, of course.
So, and then up at Sacramento State, you were, we talked last week, your band, and oh, we should go back a little bit. So you come off of, you grow up, lose your legs are amputated when you're young, and your reality is you're a double baloney amputee, you're playing baseball, you're playing basketball, you're playing all the sports, you know, other kids are putting their shoes on, you're putting your legs on, living in Tennessee. Were you accepted because everybody just knew you that way?
Yeah, you know, in my hometown, and I grew up, I love playing sports, and I use kind of basketball and baseball to kind of show people around me in my community that, you know, I'm same like you guys. Even though I'm missing my legs, I'm trying to be just like you. But even though I was able to play the sports, even all the way up to high school, varsity basketball and baseball, I knew deep down that I was different. You know, every time I left the house and every time I wore shorts, people would give me double takes and triple takes because I'm wearing prosthetic legs, and nobody's ever seen a kid like that functioning and wearing two prosthetic legs. This is almost, before – you know, the war, we went to Iraq and stuff.
Right.
And, now we see a lot more guys wearing prosthetics and wounded warriors. But back then, I was unique. I was one and only. It didn't matter if I was in Tennessee. We even traveled to see family in New York and Georgia. Wherever I went, it was like, hey, where is the circus is coming. This kid is out. Where do I get my tickets? And as a child, that was hard for me to accept and to deal with because I did not understand at that age. The only thing I really wanted to do was to be normal.
Right.
And even though I try to keep a positive attitude and use sports, the honest truth is it really messed with me at times when I would go home and have to deal with this. And why am I getting stared at? And why am I getting looked at? This, have that reality like this isn't fair.
So when you would go home and there was a point where I think it was granddad, I could be wrong, where you were having problems sleeping, it was, you know, you were doing a little self-medicating. Maybe it was grandpa said, hey, I bought a little of this. This might calm you down a little bit. Take me through getting, basically drinking for the first time and what that did for you.
Yeah, you know, I think back and I think about my first drink. You know, here I am. Every time I leave my house, you know, my this is like I kind of can see like this hamster wheel, right? There's something continuously going in my head. Why am I like this? Why do I have to walk like this? Why are my pant legs in like this? Why are they staring at me? It's like this hamster wheel that continuously just goes in your head, nonstop. The time you wake up, the time, even when you sleep, it's in your head, bothers you. And I can remember when I was around about 15, you know, 16 years old, I had my first drink. And I kind of got a little intoxicated. And it was for the first time in my life, that hamster wheel going in my head went away. It was like I was almost able to just take a deep breath and say, oh, I can finally breathe.
Then you just found this was a great escape.
Yeah, it was a great escape for me. I didn't worry about my legs. I didn't worry about being different. I didn't worry about people pointing at me, laughing at me. You know what I mean? My worries and fears and insecurities went away in that first drink, and that's something that I chased continuously from that day forward. And it kind of just led on to more. You know, every time I go into something's going wrong in my life or anything that I'm facing fears and stuff that I might be struggling with in school or, you know, future and track, I would go to that drink and I would go to the bottle to face those fears through the drink or through the bottle.
So how much were you drinking? You said you started at the age of 15. As you were getting older through high school, how much were you drinking?
Yeah, in high school, I would kind of keep it, you know, moderate on the weekend, you know, at parties because, you know, I had to come home. I had to go to school. I always try to make sure I got good grades, and I was still showing up to school, and, you know, I didn't want to get in trouble because my biggest fear was getting in trouble with my parents.
Right.
But once I kind of graduated high school because I lived in such a small town, I mean, if I'm walking around drunk with no legs, the whole town would know about it.
Yeah.
So by the time I got to college, that's when it kind of started getting a little bit out of control. It went from weekends to, okay, I'm drinking Thursday through Sunday. Then from Thursday to Sunday, I'm looking at, well, you know, I don't have that many classes on Wednesday, so we can hang out and drink on Tuesday. And this is all happening. I'm trying to find myself. You know, I was playing basketball in high school, and I went to college to be pre-med. And so between hanging out with the fellas, having organic chemistry and biology, and this is also around the time that I got the grant, you know, from CAF to become a Blade Runner.
Well, that's right. With this, you're watching on television, and you didn't know about the high-end prosthetic legs until you saw Oscar Pistorius in Beijing at the Paralympics in 2008, correct?
Yes, yes, yes. I was actually in my dorm rooms eating a bowl of Fruit Loops. and I seen Oscar. He won a gold medal, 100 meters, 200 meters, 400 meters at the Paralympic Games, and they highlighted it on ESPN's Top 10.
Right,
and I'm there watching the basketball game, trying to keep up with what's going on in basketball. And a guy with prosthetic legs pops up on national TV on ESPN. It blew my mind. I was like, "Oh my gosh, there's something out there for me. I gotta do this. I gotta be a part of this." But there was one thing that I noticed that was different: the way he had it, I didn't have, and that was the blade. And I knew for me to be competitive. And I knew I was an athlete. I played basketball in high school.
Right.
I made the who's, you know, the team of national basketball and the conference basketball. I knew I could do it. I played basketball every day. I just know I knew I needed the blades. For sure needed the blades.
And so you go online. You find the Challenge Athletes Foundation. Realize that you could get a grant. But you go to your dad and go, hey, Dad, I think this group will send me legs. And your dad's response was, nobody is going to give you $20,000 worth of legs.
Yeah. Yeah, he was like, what, they want the credit card information or something? This is too good to be true.
Right.
Right? And I was like, no, Dad, this company really works with individuals. You know, you got to think, we grew up in Tennessee.
Right.
In a small rural town. So, you know, disabled events and, you know, nonprofits that seek out to help other individuals that's in need in the disabled community wasn't really big in Tennessee. When you're in San Diego in a bigger market and a lot more people trying to experience life and take it to the next level, me coming across the Challenge Athletes Foundation is probably one of the greatest things that ever happened to me in my life. And I was able to work with them
yeah.
And get my first pair of running blades within that year.
What I love is you're out at the track with your dad. I think you've got ankle weights on or something. Your dad's got a stopwatch trying to figure out how fast you're going. The family goes to the Endeavor Games, get in the station wagon, drive 14 hours from Tennessee to Oklahoma, and you're going to run the 100, 200, and 400. You've never done a track meet before. You don't even know what these block things are, right? You see these starting blocks, and you're looking at these things like it's something from Mars. And and the guys weren't very helpful either. It's not like they were going, here, let me help you out.
Not at all. Actually, you know, they actually was kind of giving me some, like, I mean, how fast do you run? You got to understand, my training before then, my first race ever was me. I was a weight vest. Yeah. I would run hills on my hometown right by my house, and I'll go to the track. My dad had a makeshift stopwatch.
Yeah.
And I was running like 13 seconds, you know what I mean, in 100 meters, or maybe 14 seconds with my weight vest. And he would say, go. Then, you know what I mean, start the watch before he says go. It was just completely off, completely so off. And then I get to the Endeavor Games, and the guys are talking mess, and these guys I've seen in the Paralympic Games the year before, and I'm getting kind of nervous, and I was last one in the block, so I never did even know how to use the block, so I watched them, how to put their hands, their knees. I put my, you know, I'm left leg dominant, but I was running off my right leg because I didn't even understand that you're supposed to go off your strong leg. So the gun goes off. I'm running. I look up. I blow past everybody, and I actually win the event. I actually win the 100, 200,
and 400. Yeah, I win 100, 200, 400. And then you're going to Brazil to go with the coach of the team, this guy named Joaquim Cruz, who, you know, you're like, hey, just some guy who's our coach, and we're going down to Brazil. You guys get off the plane, and it's like you're with a Michael Jordan getting off a plane in the U.S. You know, all of a sudden, this guy, who is this guy Joaquim Cruz? After the people are running after him in the airport, you probably realized, okay, I better look this guy up.
Yeah, it was crazy. I get off the, you know, my first track meet ever. I'm flying to Atlanta. I meet Coach Cruz in Atlanta. I had no clue who he was. And if he was like somebody who played basketball, you know, I would know exactly who he is. You understand? I've never ran track before, so my knowledge of track, you know, gods and in the history and legends was not even in my realm. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't even know who he was. We get on the plane. I'm like, hey, what's up, Coach? How you doing? Talking to him. We get off the plane in Brazil, and it's like a mob. People are left and right are stopping him, asking for his autograph. We're going out to eat. People are like, oh my gosh, he's up. Like, they're basically bowing down to him. I'm like, who is this guy? Right? So I go and look it up. I'm like, holy smokes, I'm with, you know, the only gold medalist from the Olympics in Brazil.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because even at the track that we was competing at, his face was on the side of the track.
Oh, was it really?
Stadium.
Oh,
yeah, it was in the stadium. Funny. So, you know, I look up. Second race ever, I'm in Brazil competing on the world stage.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, very fast. You know, I actually ran faster, you know, almost break an American record. And but I posted one of the fastest times for sure in the 200 and one of the fastest times in 100 as well at that race.
What I love is how fast everything happened. And we're talking, you saw Oscar in 08. Next thing you know, you've got legs. Next thing you know, you're going to Brazil. The next thing you know, Joaquim is saying to you, Blake, I know you want to make the Paralympics, but I think you can make the Olympic team. I mean, when he tells you something like that, you've got, if you were drinking before, I'm guessing that this is like, oh my God, now there's expectations. Now there's,
man.
At that point, were you starting to get a little freaked out?
I was, and I'll kind of look back at it, and I feel like we all kind of do this sometimes, and you know, a lot of people deal with this. It's kind of almost like self-sabotage, right?
Yes.
You self-sabotage your life and, you know, and the thing that you're trying to do because you're scared of your greatness. You know, it's not that our darkness that we fear, it's our light.
Right.
It's not the fear of the darkest, the fear that we like, that we can be somebody spectacular and somebody great. So once I'm getting all these accolades and saying, oh, my gosh, you can probably be one of the fastest men, not only in Paralympics, but in the Olympics, if you really try this, I started drinking. I got nervous again. I got scared, and all this fear was happening. So, you know, when I'm at the track meets, I can keep it together barely. But once I go back home, I got all these things running in my mind, trying to be a college student. I'm back to the bottle again.
And you're trying to calm your mind down.
Trying to calm my mind down. I just flew from Atlanta to Brazil back, and went on a world travel, and now I'm back in lab trying to figure this all out within a week. And I'm the only way I know how to calm my mind down. I don't understand the art of meditating. I don't really understand the art of writing things out and analyzing things, of making the list and deep breathing. And the only thing I knew how to do was to drink. To stop that rabbit and that hamster wheel in my head, I had to drink. And this continued all through my college career. And I can remember it was a special moment for me, but it was actually a very embarrassing moment. I competed and actually trained out in San Diego for a little bit. And Coach Cruz knew that, you know, my partying and my drinking was a little bit out of control. But I was still wanted to go to school. So once he said, okay, I want you to move out to San Diego, and I went back home and I talked to my parents, and it was like Coach Cruz wants me to move out to San Diego to really focus, because he knows that I'm not keeping up with everything here. And of course, my mom actually cried when I told her that. And I made that decision there. It's like, you know what? It's not time for me to move back to San Diego. So I go back to school in the fall, and I had a track meet at my brother's college, about an hour and a half away. And I just got done doing the lab, and I had a test the day before the track meet. My parents, my grandparents, my brother, his friends, my friends, and my prosthetist all was going to come to this track meet that was 2 hours away from my college, 4 hours away from them. And the night before the track meet, I had a buddy come to me and said, Blake, man, we just got to take a test. There's a party going on. I know you run tomorrow, but let's go and just hang out for a little bit. And I was like, dude, I can't. I got to get up early in the morning. I have to go run. I can't go out. He said, look, we won't stay long.
Right? Famous last words.
Last words, we won't stay long. So, of course, I get up, we go to the party. I end up getting intoxicated. I was drunk out of my mind, basically, right?
Yeah.
Day before a race. I get back to my dorm room.
Yeah.
I get 2 hours of sleep.
Oh.
I get sick from the lack of sleep. My parents come pick me up. I'm hungover. And we're driving to this track meet. My parents are out there. My grandparents then drove 6 hours, almost 4 hours. My prosthetist and his family was out there. They drove 4 hours to watch me run this meet. And I run the slowest time I've ever ran in my life. I was so weak that I almost got blown over by the wind coming around the curve in the 200 meters.
Oh, my God. Now, did anybody know, or were you able to fool them?
No, I was able to fool them. But I can just look, at their faces. So they were so disappointed in me.
Yeah, yeah.
And just so disappointed. They were so excited. It hurt so many great, because I've been running fast.
Right.
I was training out in San Diego. I was focused, right? But I can look up and see the disappointment. I was like, right then and there, I need to make a change, right? But I made the wrong change in that moment, because I said, okay, I'm going to move back out to San Diego for good this time.
Right.
But I didn't really focus on the problem.
The problem was the drinking,
moment.
Not where you were living.
The problem was the drinking, not where I was living. And I was like, well, it's my atmosphere that's the reason why I was drinking that. The reason why I was drinking, because I couldn't say no in that moment.
Right.
It was not the people around me, because wherever you go, people are going to ask you to go out and hang out. But I just couldn't say no in that moment. That was the problem, not where I was at. So I blamed, of course, pointing fingers. It's their fault. It's my friend's fault. It's the people around me's fault. So I'm going to drop everything. I'm going to drop out of school, and I'm going to move out to San Diego to get extremely focused for the Paralympic Games in 2012. And that'll give me about a year and a half to get ready for that.
Well, and so when I remember talking to Joakim, and Joakim was telling me, says, Bob, the one thing about Blake, he's pretty honest. So I'll send him these workouts, and then I'll say to him, so, Blake, what percentage of these workouts are you doing? And most people will tell me, you know, lie. They'll say I'm doing 90%, 80%. Blake, like 5, 10. I'm doing nothing. He says, yeah, at least he's telling me the truth. But you know, the reality is he's not training, right? So, and then when you came out, I remember I was at the track. You're running repeat 200s, and Joe, I'm going, why is he stopping by the bushes over there? And Joe goes, like, he's puking. And I'm like, what? He's doing 200 repeats. Now, I didn't know about the alcohol thing. And at that point, I don't know if Joakim did. But he was like, he doesn't know how to pace himself. He doesn't know when he's doing 10 200s that, you know, you don't do the first one as hard as you can and puke.
Yeah.
But
I was hungover.
You were hungover. Yeah, yeah. So it's funny because I didn't know about I'm so oblivious to this stuff. So when you make the team and you're going to London, again, you've only been in this sport for a little while. You're,
yeah, 2 years, two and a half years.
2.5 years. Whole family's come over to London. Your granddad, who'd never been on a plane in his life, the first flight he took was to come to London to watch his grandson run in the Paralympics.
Yeah. And it's crazy. 85,000 people. Oscar Pistorius. I run eight races. 7 out of 8 races, Oscar's in those races.
Wow.
And he just got off. He just got off the Olympic run.
Exactly.
It's crazy, right? And
yeah.
I'm going in with the world leading fastest time. I ran faster than Oscar in the 100 meters and in the 200 meters that year, because the only thing he was focusing on was the 400 meters.
Right. Because he was going to the regular Olympics in 400.
Yeah, because he was going to the able-bodied Olympics. So I was favored. Even though people, you know, had respected Oscar and everything, I was still favored to win the 100 and 200 meters that year to gold in London to beat Oscar.
What I was going to say is, so you're in the stadium, and most of the time when you're doing track meets or para-track meets, there's 12 people in the stands. There's mom, there's dad, there's, you know, some guy who's lost. There's not a lot of people. There's 85,000 people. You got the big screen, and it's right after the Olympics. So the people in England who love these sports anyways, they have just watched Oscar in the regular Olympics. That was a huge story. So that was a turning point for the Paralympics, is seeing that crowd. Now, people can either shrink from the spotlight or embrace the spotlight. And I remember being in that stadium, watching the camera going to each person. This is before the finals, the 200. And I'm like, okay, we're going to find out right now which one is Blake. And you're jumping up and down, pointing at the camera, and I'm going, okay, Blake is going to be fine. You love the spotlight.
Yeah, I do. I guess I don't know if it's because I was born with that legs, and all eyes has kind of been on me since I was a young kid. But I love having the spotlight. I love being in front of the crowd to show people what I truly can do with what I have.
Right.
And once that camera came on, I seen Leaper in the stands, and even though in the 400 pet race, Oscar was running almost 3 seconds faster than me at that time. I knew I was going to get my butt kicked, but it didn't matter. It's all about attitude.
Yeah, and in that 200, so you're coming down the final stretch of 200, and you're in fourth, right? Third is a medal, fourth is nothing.
Right.
And you've got a baseball background, and all of a sudden we see the Pete Rose with you launching.
Yes.
How long was it before you knew you got a medal?
It took almost a minute and a half. but when you're talking about a minute and a half, when you know your life could change for forever, medal or no medal, it was long, because they already put first and second, and we had to wait there almost about a minute and a half to see who took third. Because when I dove across the line, it was the torso who crosses first, and not the body itself, not the head. And I knew that from the year before, because one of my teammates, Jerome Singleton, did the same thing to Oscar. And it's funny, one of the Olympic women's 400 last year, one of the girls from the Bahamas did that to Allison Felix, dove across the line in the 400 meters.
So
a lot of people don't realize it's their torso that crosses first.
If your head's ahead of them?
Yeah. If not the head, it's just the torso from your shoulders to your waist. That's what they measure. Not your head. Now, it can't be your hand. It's your torso.
Fascinating. So you get the bronze, and the whole family. How many family members were there?
It was about 7 family members. I had 2 aunts, an uncle, my grandmother, my grandfather, and mom and dad. So it's crazy. You know, my grandfather never flew a day in his life, and I get the bronze, and I go meet them under the stadium right after I get the bronze, and I look over in the corner, and my grandfather's crying like a 2-year-old baby. Like,
you've never seen him cry before?
That was my first time ever seeing him cry a day in my life.
Wow.
And it was just tears of happiness. He was just so excited for his grandson being born without legs, so much worry and you know, just so much things going in his mind and his heart, seeing his name, not only my name and last name, but it's his last name as well.
Right.
In front of 85,000 people, in front of the whole world, just really brought pure happiness. The only thing he could do was just cry.
So you take the bronze there. You get take the 200 behind Oscar Pistorius, one space placed behind Oscar in both races. And how did your life change?
It was crazy. You know, I take the bronze and I take the silver, and you know, I got my own Blake Lieber Day back in my hometown, Keys to the City.
Yep.
I started doing, you know, TV shows, interviews, Queen Latifah. I was in the NBA Celebrity All-Star Game.
Yep.
I walked the it was with Kevin Hart, you know, Common, Nick Cannon. I walked the red carpet for Naomi Campbell. It was just so many amazing things, you know, just started happening to me within these past 2.5-3 years when I decided I even wanted to be a runner. And the honest truth is, I didn't know how to handle it.
Right.
Remember, I moved from my situation thinking I would handle the problem, but that wasn't handling the problem. I was just trying to fix it quick. My biggest problem was just trying to stop drinking when I get fearful and things start getting too excited for me. And once all this crazy thing started happening in a good way in my life, the only thing I knew how to do to calm myself down was to go back to the bottle.
And with all this, I remember Joakim telling me that he would take your pass away in the Olympic Village during London Games because he knew you would go out and drink. And he needed to take your accreditation away so that you couldn't leave the village.
That's crazy to even think about that. Like, he literally had to take my pass away so I would stay and be stuck in the village so I can focus.
Right.
And the crazy thing about that, to even get food in the village, you needed your pass. So every time I had to go eat or get food, he had to escort me to the cafeteria to make sure I go straight to the cafeteria and leave. Because he knew I had the potential, but he knew that if I had the slightest chance to go out the village to get a drink, I would.
Wow.
And it was interesting because I lost, you know, I was the favorite in the 100 meters in London, and I actually had a bad race, you know, just inexperienced. I take fifth, and we actually got DQ'd the night before in the relay.
Right.
So I lost 2 medals in 2 days, right before the 400 meters.
Oh.
And I was so upset, and even though I had a 400 meters left, I actually left the village, got my pass, because he had to give me my pass while I compete, and had a drink.
Did you really?
I did. Yes, I did. And that's the only way. It's just unfortunate I think about that, being on the world stage at the highest level, and I just didn't know how to handle things. I just didn't know how to cope with failures in life. And that's the one thing I've learned, you know, here recently, is that we're going to have our failures, but you got to learn how to deal with life on life's terms.
So a couple years ago, and I think it was around the World Championships, you know, obviously everything is going great. Everybody's talking Blake Lieber, you know, big hope for the next for 2016. And,
yeah.
And you end up testing positive for cocaine.
Yeah.
And I remember leaving voicemails because, you know, Jeff Nowitzki and these drug guys are serious dudes. And
yes.
The most important thing to do is to tell the truth. Because it's not the crime, it's a cover-up.
Yes.
So when you tested positive cocaine, what was the reaction?
Yeah, I was just in denial. You know, the whole time, I couldn't believe it. I put in a situation again to where I couldn't just say no in that moment.
Yeah.
I was still under the influence, making terrible decisions. Here I am, I break an American record, and had a test after I go 47. It was like 47.9 at the time. And a week before trials. And it was a situation where that bit a no-brainer could easily, you know, the no-brainer decision, like, dude, I got trials. There's no way I'd even be around this. But I couldn't say no. And so I couldn't. And then I was such an in denial, knowing I was going to lose the Olympics. I was going to lose sponsorship. I tried to say, it wasn't me. It wasn't me. It was somebody else. It wasn't me. It can't be me. I don't do that. And,
right.
And unfortunately, it ended up costing me.
So you go positive for cocaine. And then when you say, hey, it's not me, because if you had just said, you know what, it's recreational drug, I used it, you would have gotten maybe 6 months because it wasn't performance. It's not performance enhancing, it's performance de-enhancing, right?
Right, exactly.
And people can look at that and go, hey, you know, who hasn't made a performance de-enhancing mistake? You weren't trying to improve your ability to win a race. So, but when they say, okay, well, if you didn't do it, then let us test do a hair sample. And your response to that was what?
Yeah, that can't happen.
Yeah. So you shaved your body.
I'm gonna get truly exposed, which that was, you know, another mistake.
Yeah.
That was at the time I was still under the influence and making terrible decisions. And it just put me in a bad situation where they had no choice you know, they originally say, hey, we you know, maybe we should give you a 2-year ban.
Right. And so, yeah, so you shave the hair off so they can't do a hair test. So now they give you a 2-year ban. And the thought was, you know what, USADA could lower that to 1 year, because you've said to me in the past, going positive was the best thing that ever happened to me, because it forced me to deal with the situation. It forced me to get into a program and to become clean.
Exactly.
How long, you've been clean for how long now?
Almost 22 months now. So in that later year of 2015, that's when I walked into to my first recovery meeting. Mm-hmm. And then once I walked into my first recovery meeting and standing up in front of a crowd and saying, you know what, guys, my name is, you know, Blake, and I do have a issue, and I do have a problem. And just seeing grown men in that recovery meeting, you know, talk about their story and all the struggles and the failures and how they battled back from that and how they had nothing and they lost their jobs and their families but you know, today they don't have to have a drink and they're regaining it all back. It gave me power. It gave me strength. They said, Blake, do you have anything to say? And I stood up and said, you know, my name is Blake and I have an issue and I have a problem. Once I did that, it was so much weight lifted off my shoulders.
Yeah.
Because when I admitted that I had a problem, the good thing, and this is what people don't really realize, is once you admit you have a problem, with not only admitting that you have a problem, that you come to a realization, okay, then now we can find a solution.
So,
and that was the greatest thing that ever happened to me.
And what did you learn about yourself just through all of this? Because I'm guessing that going positive cost you, getting this ban cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yes, hundreds of thousands of dollars. It cost me at least 2 gold medals that I for sure know I would have won in the Paralympic Games last year.
Yeah.
It cost me so much embarrassment, not only to me, but you can imagine, I'm like the hometown hero, you know, born without legs, making it being one of the first Olympians ever in my hometown. You know, I had my own day model, so my family was so embarrassed. You know, I didn't have to like go out. It's a small town, so when they go out, these people are talking, hey, that's such and such parents. You hear about what he did.
Sure.
You know, not only that, but it was just a lot of humility. I lost so much in that moment and in that time period. But I'm telling you, Bob, what I gained, you know, what I was able to accomplish because I had to go through this experience and be humble and everything be taken away. Because at that moment, when I tested positive, you know, I almost lost the love for track and field.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was a hassle for me to have to show up at practice. Like, oh, man, I got to show up again. All right, I guess I'll do this again. You know what I mean? It's going to stop my drinking. It's going to stop my partying, right? Partying and hanging out and being cool and being on TV was way more important than training and practicing.
I know.
But once it was taken away from me and, you know, I couldn't do that no more. I couldn't go out there and compete no more. I gained the love back for just showing up and just competing again. And sometimes that's what happens in life. Things have to be taken away from us so we can appreciate it. And for that to happen to me and still have enough time to come back and battle back was the best thing I could ever ask for.
I remember just thinking, you know, hey, you know, Blake's got a big track meet next week. Oh, but he has a chance to go on $10,000 pyramid. So he's flying to New York overnight and then coming back and he won't have time to train. And, you know, it's like we forget that what happens between the lines is what makes everything else possible.
Exactly.
And we take part of it for granted.
Yeah, and I lost that. I'm like, hey, I'm gonna go out here and make money. You know what I mean?
Right.
This is the most money I ever made in my life. I can't turn down this engagement, or I can't turn up. But that was the whole reason why they wanted me, because I was a champion.
Right.
And that was because I was one of the best in the world. But if I'm not the best in the world, they don't even want me. What's the point of even showing up at all these events? And I kind of lost track and got distracted. And I hope a lot of people and kids kind of hear from that part of my story, is that when you're on top or when you are the best in the world, the hardest thing to do is to stay focused. Because everybody's going to be dragging you and pulling you and want a piece of you when you're the best in the world.
And I know, you know, listen, there's no surprise about this. You've got a personality that's off the charts. You've got a smile that's an 8 million megawatt smile. You're a very special young man who has that it star quality that you and I, I've always felt that, and I've always known that. And I know a big part of who you are is these kids. And I'm betting that was one of the hardest things for you was when these kids sort of gave you that look like, is this true?
Oh, man, that was so rough. You know, I've had, you know, some coaches come up to me and say, you know, when such and such heard about you testing, you know, for cocaine, you know, they cried when they heard about it.
Yeah.
Right? And that just broke my heart. You know what I mean? Or when a kid would come up to me, when you competing again? You know what I mean? And they have to say, well, I can't compete right now because of my mistakes off the track. One of the hardest things for me to do was to watch not only the Paralympic Games in 2016, where I couldn't be there and watch all my teammates walk through the stands, but to have to sit in the stands this past year and watch the Paralympic Trials.
Right.
And that actually was in L.A., on my home track that I train at UCLA. Like, I had to sit there and watch. Because of my past mistakes and my failures that I made 2 years ago, that was one of the hardest things to do, to not be able to go out there and compete for the kids. I hated that, Bob. I truly did.
Well, one of the things, and you and I have chatted about this in the past, too, is International Paralympic Committee, from my perspective, you would have been such a great spokesperson because you cannot be alone. You cannot be the only person who's missing legs, in a wheelchair, who's an athlete and a star when they open up the door, but when they go home, they struggle with the fact that this is their lot in life, and they have a lot of challenges going on, and maybe they don't feel they deserve what they're getting. You can speak to that. Did they ever reach out to you and say, hey, Blake, listen, you know what? You'd be a great role model to talk about this unseen problem that it's out there. You weren't out just doing this stuff alone. There was a lot of guys who are drinking and doing recreational drugs who could learn from your story. Did IPC or anybody from that group ever reach out and say, Blake, let's use you as our spokesperson to overcome this?
Yeah, and that was the unfortunate part about it. It was, I talked it over with USADA and the U.S. Paralympics, and they was on my side.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Hey, let's turn this thing around. You learned from your lessons. We've obviously see that you are doing better each and every day, and let's use this to inspire more people because, like you said, I'm not the only one that probably is going through this, but the unfortunate part about it, you know, in that moment, I felt like the IPC couldn't see the bigger picture. And even though, you know, I came to a settlement and agreement for me to, as long as I hold up my end of the deal of facing this head on and staying clean and promoting that, you know, I made a mistake, but I changed my life around. And I qualified and won at Paralympic Trials last year, U.S. Paralympic Trials, and went 46.1 and broke two American records.
Yep.
And thought I made the team. U.S. Paralympics put me on the team and decided it was supporting me. But getting a phone call 2 weeks later saying the IPC saying that they don't want me in the track meet. Was really a slap in the face.
Well, what's interesting to me is USADA has made a lot of rulings over the years, and I don't know if IOC or IPC has ever overruled one before. Do you know?
No, not that I know of. I think this is one of the first of its kind, and that was the unfortunate part because we thought, you know, we came to a point to where it's going to be beneficial for everybody.
Yep.
And that was I think that's the whole purpose of taking each other's stories and lives and getting it out there so it can help other people. But I just feel like in that moment, I don't know what's going on in the people who made the decision on the IPC side's head. But I feel like they missed the mark on that one. And that's just that's a biased opinion coming from me because I didn't get the run in the Paralympic Games.
Right.
But I just feel like they missed the whole mission on this and to inspire others. That overcome challenges and disabilities, and be having an addiction and dealing with that can be a disability at times. It can be a major challenge, and that's something that I was hoping I could share with the world.
Well, to be honest, and you and I have chatted about this before. You have a nobody wants this to happen to them. But right. I think your story is richer now because it's not just overcoming. You know, beginning of conversation was, hey, I was born without legs. That was my reality from a little kid. The way right. I dealt with it was drinking. And
right.
then it got to the point where that drinking controlled me. And
exactly.
I needed to control the drinking to get my life back. So right now we're in chapter two. First of all, how hard was that 2 years? Because that just ended, June 21st?
Since June 21st. The 2 years were incredibly hard. You know, I'm living on a budget. I'm not making as much money. I'm still trying to train. I had to rebuild back myself. Like for the first couple months, I wasn't even eating, sleeping, or working out at all.
Yeah, right.
So I can remember going into my. I ended up moving up to LA, getting a new trainer. Working with some new training partners. And I walked in. I hopped on a scale with my new weight room trainer, and I was 134 pounds.
What? Oh my God.
And 34 pounds from not being able to eat or sleep or do anything because I was just so depressed for the first couple of months. And, you know, it's a crazy thing now. Right now, I mean, we've gained almost 20 to 25 pounds of muscle back on me. You know, I fluctuate from like 155 to 160 right now. And it's just crazy to think. But we just went back, you know, to the grind. You know, I grinded hard. I got back to just loving the process and loving to grind this whole 2 years. I'm not gonna lie, at the beginning it was extremely hard, and there's been multiple times throughout the 2 year process that I really wanted to give up. I didn't think I could do it no more.
Sure.
I'm gonna be honest, but I thought back, you know, where I come from. The interesting part that I love to tell people is the characteristics that I learned to overcome my situation being born without legs was the same characteristics that I needed to overcome this situation in my life when being suspended and have to control my drinking and control my addiction.
So, Willie Gault, 85, Super Bowl champion, Olympic gold medalist, becomes your coach up in L.A.
Yes.
And what was his message to you?
Man, his message is, if you work hard and you grind hard and give 120%, I'll give you 120%. And this coming from a Super Bowl champion, a guy who's never took a drink in his life.
Wow.
And so Willie has never drank a day in his life, and I used to drink every day of my life. So it was pretty cool just to be around that greatness. He knows what it takes to be the best in the world. He's not only a world record holder, but, you know, a world champion and been to the Olympics and Super Bowl. He just knows what it takes. And having that mindset and having that type of vision was very beneficial.
So this last weekend, you're going to come down here and run in at Mesa College.
Yeah.
And then you called and said, you know what? I just got invited. USA Track and Field. So you couldn't run in the paratri stuff, but USA Track and Field calls you to come run at Sacramento State against the able-bodied guys.
Yeah. And that was the interesting part. I couldn't run at the U.S. Paralympic trials, but the way the timing of my suspension and how everything worked, I was able to compete and run at the U.S. Outdoor Able Body Trials. And I got the phone call. Literally, I was on my way to my trainer's house to go rent a car to drive down to San Diego the next day. And I get a phone call Tuesday night saying, hey, you got into the U.S. Outdoor Trials. You was number 32 out of 32 to get in. You're the last person in. And I knew right then my life was going to change for forever in a good way.
Chapter 2 starts. You go to Sacramento, and you go 45-52, something like that?
Yes, 45-52 in the prelims. I was in lane 4, and, you know, it's the first race I ever had in the whole year. I almost scared myself because the gun goes off. You know I've been training hard, and, you know, one of my training partner actually took second at the event. He's actually going on the way to London. He has the third fastest time in the world, so training with him let me know that I can be with the best of the world. But once you're there, it's totally different. So I get out the blocks, I get around the turn, and I'm actually with you guys. Like I'm running long right beside them, stride for stride. And it kind of scared me. I'm like, whoa, I'm going way too fast. I'm too excited. Let me slow it down a little bit. So I slow it down a little bit going into the 200 mark, get to the 250, come off the curve, going to the 300, 350, and I start kicking a little bit. And the crowd starts going a little bit crazy, and I start pushing. And they're like, whoa, it went from an inspirational sympathy story to, wait, this kid can run.
Exactly.
So I push towards the end. I kind of get almost too excited, but I finish the run, And I get edged out a little bit. They run 45.39, and I went 45.5.
Wow.
So it was actually a pretty close race. And I actually, but the crazy thing part about it at the beginning, I finished the race, and one more heat, the heat ran just a little bit faster, and I was 17th out of the group that night, 17 out of 32, and they took the top 16 guys.
Yeah.
So then the guy who was right in front of me ran 3/1000ths of a second faster than me. So they're congratulating me, saying, "You ran a really good race. You broke the American record. Good job. You know, man, it's amazing." But I'm upset. Like, I could have went faster. I should have supposed to be in semifinals. This isn't, you know, dang it. You know, first race of the season. I told myself, I'm upset. I'm mad.
Yeah.
Now I go do my cool down with my teammate who actually won his heat. And we get back from the cool down. And another coach that was at the practice track comes up to me and says, "Hey, not trying to freak you out, but you made the semifinal. Somebody got DQ'd."
Wow. How fun is that?
I got in number 16, and I just knew I had another shot to go for the record. I mean, I knew the guys were going to go really, really fast, but it put me in a situation to try to really break the record because I really wanted to go 40, but faster than 45.39.
So the American record is 45.39, and you go 45.25.
Yeah,
now is that a world record and an American record, or we know
yet? Yeah, it was a world record. Officially, it was a world record and American record. So if you go and look at the Paralympic world record, and the one that Oscar Pistorius actually holds that he ran in 2011 in Daegu with the able-bodied world championships, it is a 45.39 officially. It's officially 45.39. So with the 45.25 officially, then it gives me the world record.
How cool. So your first track meet back, you go 45.52 and then 45.25, and you break the American world record.
Back-to-back, 2 days in a row.
Welcome back.
Yeah, it feels so good to be back. Going through all of that, but, you know, Bobby, I tell you, I compare the two, and, you know, I used to have to drink and use to kind of get high, to feel okay, to feel right. But that process that I went through, and being sober and experiencing that moment and seeing everybody excited and proud for me and being back on the track and breaking the world record, that's the greatest high that I could ever get in life.
That was the greatest
feeling in the world.
So the family now, with you being back, and I'm guessing that they could see the change in you because you've been, you know, you've been sober for basically 2 years now.
Yes, they definitely can. I mean, I answer the phone now.
Oh, you're kidding.
I can FaceTime him now. You know, back then, you know, a couple of years ago, I wouldn't even answer. I would go weeks and maybe a month or two without even talking to him. Just be off the grid.
Yes, you were.
I
know you were off the grid. I'd be calling you, and you're like, I was calling you. You'd disappear. No.
Yeah, I would just disappear because I would just be ashamed of the state of mind or, you know, where I was at in my life at that moment. I knew I couldn't answer the phone and get away with it. But now, you know, I'm an open book. I have nothing to hide. I am who I am, and I say I'm a perfect human being. I still make mistakes today, but, you know, the mistakes that I do make and the fears that I do face, I face those. You know, I face them, and I rise on each and everything that I face today.
So what's the goal now?
The goal now is to go faster.
Yeah.
The goal now is to become one of the fastest men in the world. The goal now is to go 44 seconds. You know, I have a lot more training to do, and I have, a lot more things to accomplish, but this is just the beginning. I really think, you know, with more training, with more, you know, staying humble and staying focused, I could potentially be one of the fastest men in the world. I want to make finals next year. I went to semifinals at U.S. Outdoor Championships. It was great, but I want to make finals. I want to make a team, and I just want to be the best human being that I can be today.
So what has been the response from the able-bodied runners? Because, you know, we've heard the grumblings, oh, you have an advantage. You've got a prosthetic, and that makes you faster because you can be as tall as you want. They're springy, all that type of stuff. What do you hear from the other runners?
Yeah, I mean, from the other runners when I was there, it was a lot of support. You know, they said, we're kind of glad that you're here. You know what I mean? That you're pushing. It's very inspirational. Now, I didn't beat the top runner, so it wasn't that much of an issue.
Right.
So,
yes.
But I got a lot of support from a lot of the guys, you know. But we'll see how that goes once I become a threat, you know,
exactly.
into the able-bodied world. Once you start winning, the tone becomes
changes.
Different. But it changes. And, I'm ready for that, and I accept that, because at the end of the day, all I can do is compete and run as fast as I can to be the best person I can be.
So the when you look at the last year, I think it was last year, where they had you guys running on, looked like you're running on stubbies. All of a sudden, yeah. IPC came up with, and who knows where they came up with their formula, but all of a sudden you were running at like 5'8". Hunter was, what, 5'9"?
Yeah,
somebody else
crazy.
Was 5'6". How do we know that they're just not going to randomly pick out new numbers and put you guys on really, really short legs again? What have they told you when they're going to decide what's going to happen for the next Paralympics?
Nah, not yet. You know, they're still kind of scrambling around trying to figure things out. And, you know, I kind of leave it up to them. Unfortunately, they haven't got it right yet. And I mean, to be honest, I don't think that they ever will. You know,
no.
To say that you as a human being, how can you tell me how tall I should be?
Right.
Or what I should wear. You know, everybody is born in all kinds of shapes and sizes, and we're just trying to compete at our best of our abilities. So to try to regulate that is something that I really don't agree with. And I'm curious to see what's going to happen in the future. But for right now, I'm just going to go out there and with the blades that I have and, you know, with things and the talent that I do have, I'm just going to give the best I got and keep training and staying focused on that and let that take care of itself.
What I've always loved about the sprinters is I look at you guys as sort of gunfighters, right? You've got,
yeah.
You know, there's a little psychological stuff going on. Guys are jumping up and down in the blocks. And when I look at your category specifically, you've got Liam from New Zealand. You've got Hunter and Blake from the U.S. There's some German guys. You guys are in a position where there's more name recognition and more personality from the para athletes than I think we get from what we call quote unquote the able-bodied athletes. You guys chatted at all about, hey guys, you know, this IPC stuff is great, but we need to get ourselves together here so that if they come out with some ruling and make us 5'5", that we can say, you know what, we're part of a different circuit here and we really don't need you guys.
Yeah, you know, we've started the conversation a little bit that, you know, we are stronger together than we are divided.
Yes.
And we really understand that, and it's going to take a lot more conversation, but we all kind of get, I feel like we get the bigger picture and the bigger mission that together we can take on the world. You know, together we can accomplish great things and break down barriers, and we're kind of preparing ourselves and getting ready for that, just in case it doesn't go our way for the future. Each and every guy are special individuals and running extremely fast. And I'm excited to have not only have that battle, but to come together as brothers. You know, I always kind of think of each other as blade brothers.
Yep.
You know, we might be different from different countries, different lifestyles, and different worlds, but together, blades, running on prosthetic blades has brought us together as brothers. And I think it's exciting what we're going to be able to accomplish in the future, not only individually, but together as well.
So the technology, when you look at where blades have come from when you first started, how much better are they now than they were back in 2009, 2010?
They're amazing. You know, just back in 2009 and 10, you know, they were just getting there. But, you know, we're getting more research. We're getting more kids running, and not only adults, but kids running on them as well. That's,
right.
That's, you know, when they're 9 and 10 years old. And I'm just excited for the future, where it's going to go. Is, you know, back in the day, it was crazy to see a double-leg amputee. I would get 2 stairs, 3 stairs when I was a kid. Now when I'm on the street, somebody comes up to me and says, hey, I seen a guy just like you the other day on TV. I seen a guy just like you, you know, walking down the street. And that's pretty inspiring what you guys are doing, and that's just amazing where it's going, where it's at right now, and what it can be.
Blake, congrats on everything you've done. Just
thank you
know,
so
just
much,
watching you from your early days with your, you know, that first CAF grant and then coming every year to San Diego Triathlon Challenge. And you know, obviously, we want you involved with Challenge Athletes Foundation forever and ever and ever. It's great to have you back, and great to, I know how inspiring you are to other kids. You give people hope, and the great thing now is you've given yourself hope.
Yeah, that's an exciting part. Now, I truly believe in myself, deep, full wholehearted, and I'm excited for what's going to happen in the future.
Love it. Blake Leeper has been our guest, American and world record holder, 45-25 for 400 meters. That's sort of nice to say. I love that. Blake, you are the legend, my man.
Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate it.
I just love everything you're doing. And I, like I said, your story is so much richer now. I think you impact, there's a lot of people out there who are dealing with substance issues who aren't missing legs, who can relate to what you're going, what have gone through and what you've overcome. So, you know what, it's chapter two of the Blake Leeper story is just starting.
Getting going. Thank you so much, Bob. I appreciate it.
You are very welcome. Blake Leeper has been a guest. We're brought to you by RunCatalina.com. Catalina Eco Marathon, Half Marathon, 10K. Coming up Saturday, November 18th, Tough Man Triathlon Series. That's toughmantri.com. VeloFix.com, the coolest mobile bike shop around. ATVSwimSpas.com, the official training vessel for six-time Ironman World Champion Dave Scott, our Challenged Athletes Foundation. DonateCAF.com to help the next Blake Leeper get the prosthetics he needs to stay in a game of life through sport. You can check out challengedathletes.org for all of the amazing stories. And you can check out any of our interviews, babbittville.com or on iTunes. And until next time, remember, endurance lives here.